Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here we are, the first working day of Obama's second term. And now that the speech is done, it's all over, but the paying for it. The Obama economy on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 22nd of January. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. You know, there was a stretch back early in President Obama's first term, a couple of months, maybe 100 days or so, where he and his administration could say, and they did, hey, this isn't my economy. Do you see what the last guy left me with? Now, of course, it's an all-Obama show, and how the president handles the Obama economy would seem to be a looming challenge for the next 4 years. Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff gets us going today.
4 years ago, the president could legitimately say he inherited a mess. Unemployment was about to hit 10%. The auto industry was on the verge of collapse. Don't get me started on real estate. And the stock markets were in free fall. Well, now it's 2013, and President Obama is inheriting his own economy. How does it look?
Is underperforming.
That's Republican economist Douglas Holtz Aiken of the American Action Forum. How about Michael Linden of the left-leaning Center for American Progress?
He still has to deal with some of the hangover effects from the enormous recession.
And Joe Minerick of the Nonpartisan Committee for Economic Development.
We are beginning to see an acceleration in the economy.
Now the unemployment rate is below 8%. The auto industry is back. Home sales and the stock market are near five-year highs. But Minerick says Obama's first term was defined by short-term economic policies.
I think that was one of the worst aspects of our budgetary situation.
Just today at a House committee hearing, MIT economics professor Simon Johnson suggested that lawmakers were holding the economy hostage. He urged them to raise the debt ceiling now or else.
You will continue to undermine the private sector. You will continue to delay investment and to reduce employment.
Linden of the Center for American Progress says this is all tied to Obama's promise to strengthen the middle class.
Unemployment is still high, although it is coming down. Inequality is rising.
But Holt Aiken says the debt is the number one issue. Countries with debts as large as ours, he says,
grow more slowly and face a greater risk of crisis.
And we haven't even mentioned the fragile global economy. So, Mr. President, good luck on term number two. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
The president's address yesterday has by now been thoroughly dissected, language, tone, and content. So, on to other matters, like what everybody was wearing. The Obama women, fair or not, all three of them, and how their inaugural style choices might trickle down market. As we usually do when we want to talk fashion, we've called fashion writer Kate Betts. Hey, Kate, how are you?
I'm good, Kai. How are you?
I'm good. So listen, we'll get to the First Lady in a minute, but my reading of the fashion press this morning, such as it is that Sasha and Malia are the new thing with those coats and the dresses,
well,
right?
It's funny because I was thinking that when I saw her come out of the car to go to the church, and she was wearing this sort of darker, more somber outfit, and the two girls were in those brilliant colors. And I thought, oh, maybe this is the First Lady's way of saying, okay, now it's all about the next generation, you know?
Do you actually think Mrs. Obama thinks about this stuff when she chooses designers and all that for the high-profile events that she does?
Well, I do, because I think that every political image is thought about carefully. And I think especially in these big moments where the whole world is watching, I think she's thinking very carefully about it. You know, mostly I hope she's thinking carefully about it for the fashion business, because it gives the American fashion business such a big boost.
Well, let's get down to brass tacks here. And I want to stick with the girls for a second, because that's kind of the thing that's all buzzy out there. Kate Spade and J. Crew, are they now going to sell more stuff because an 11 and a 14-year-old girl wore it on Inauguration Day?
Yeah, I think so. Yes,
really?
In fact, I can probably guarantee that.
Is that where we are now?
Yeah, that's where we are. But I think that's where we've always been. I mean, if you look at First Ladies going all the way back to, you know, Frances Cleveland, people were cutting their hair the way she cut her hair and wearing things that she wore and buying products that she bought. I mean, the First Lady has always had that kind of power.
Yeah, so First Ladies I get, right? I mean, that makes sense. But we're talking about teenagers here. I mean, what's that about?
You mean in terms of people emulating their style?
Yeah.
I think that, you know, teenagers are watching those girls. Everybody's watching those girls. And yesterday, obviously, they were very much on display and they were wearing these gorgeous coats. And I think, you know, teenagers are into fashion, too. So why not?
So as these girls get older now and as they are more in the public eye, are we going to see more of this?
Well, I think we will see a lot more of it, and we'll see more risk-taking because they are teenagers. And as they become, you know, older teens, they'll start dressing themselves more and taking more risks, and that'll be interesting. I mean...
Yeah, oh, yeah, right? But I have a tough time believing Michelle...
Get ready for goth Malia. Yeah.
See, I would pay money to see that. Kate Betts, her book is called... actually, it's about Michelle Obama. It's called Everyday Icon, Michelle Obama and the Power of Style. Kate, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kai.
So I don't know what they were wearing, but traders on Wall Street were doing some buying today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. British Prime Minister David Cameron is set to make a big speech tomorrow, one that could conceivably upset a couple of apple carts. Britain's future in the European Union will be the topic at hand, because even though the Brits don't belong to that inner core of European countries that use the euro, the single currency, the eurozone debt crisis is weighing heavily in London, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
He hasn't made it yet, but Cameron's speech has already been hailed a turning point, almost on a par with some other famous utterances in British history.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall never surrender.
Churchill in 1940, responding to the threat of a German invasion. And then Margaret Thatcher in 1990, on the prospect of Britain adopting a common European currency.
No! Yeah. No! Yeah. No!
Cameron's speech will deal with the same age-old issue. How does Britain keep its European partners at bay? Grant Shapps, chairman of Cameron's Conservative Party, says it's time to renegotiate the terms of Britain's EU membership.
Since Europe itself needs to change because of the euro problems, then surely this is the moment to also put into place a new relationship for Britain in Europe.
Tomorrow, Cameron should spell out which powers he would like to see brought back to Britain from Brussels, like the power to limit the working week. He may also call for a referendum on whether Britain should pull out of the EU altogether. A majority of Brits just might well vote to leave.
We're being ruled too much by Europe, that's the point.
I don't like the way we have lost our sovereignty. If I had the choice today, I would come out. I would say now, come out, and I still believe we can go it on our own.
But I think we should stay in, but on our terms.
Michael O'Brien, Barbara Rawlings and Clive Wood. The danger is that the rest of Europe may not concede any new terms and Britain might stumble out of the EU. That worries big business. Paul Everett speaks for auto manufacturers.
50% of our exports go to the European market. A strong voice for the UK in Europe is absolutely essential for our future.
And the US is worried too. A senior State Department official said on the record the US would prefer Britain to stay in the EU, earning this rebuke from British lawmaker Peter Bone.
I think she butt out of our affairs. It's nothing to do with the Americans. They ought to concentrate on looking after their own affairs and not meddling with us.
But President Obama has also weighed in with a phone call to Cameron. The US intervention has been welcomed by the opposition Labour Party, and in language now familiar to Americans, Labour's leader said David Cameron is taking Britain to the edge of an economic cliff. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
. 2012 was not the greatest of years for the daily deal business, Groupon most particularly. Its shares are off 76% the past 12 months. Its business model has been called fundamentally flawed. Down, however, is not out. You can still get discounts on everything from burgers to bamboo bathrobes, whatever those are. But as of last night, there is at least one thing you can't get a Groupon for anymore. Anything related to guns. Marketplace's David Weinberg checked out the vanished deals.
James Moncherry first started using the daily deal site Living Social in October 2011 to offer deals on the firearm conceal and carry classes his company, Active Defense Awareness Training, offers.
And we had some excellent success with them.
So he launched a campaign with Groupon, and that was also a success. But 1 month after the Newtown Elementary shooting sparked a debate over gun control, Groupon said it received a number of complaints about its gun-related deals, so it pulled all of them, including Moncherry's.
For me, my logical question is, well, how many people complained?
Moncherry said that Groupon could not give him an exact number. The company only issued a statement saying that based on performance and customer feedback, firearm-related deals are not a right fit right now. Moncherry is now looking for other daily deal sites that will accept his business. He has a promising lead at one called Deal Chicken. But he is also spending more on ads in gun magazines.
To be quite frank, we're starting to look at the fact that maybe we don't need the deal sites anymore.
Rakesh Agarwal is an analyst at Redesign Mobile. He says the loss of revenue from gun-related deals is pretty immaterial.
It's more about what the social media impact will be.
Several pro-gun groups have announced that they are boycotting Groupon. But because daily deal sites do most of their business in urban areas that tend to favor gun control, Agarwal says, overall, the risk of losing business is pretty low for daily deal companies. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
So I'll tell you, some days you just don't know what this world is coming to. First Hostess and Twinkies, now Atari and Pong. One of video gaming's most storied names has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. You remember Atari, right? Made some of the first gaming consoles back in the late 1970s. And the company has lived through a number of near-death experiences since then. But as Marketplace's Queenie Kim reports, this time could be game over.
It sounds downright primitive today, but this game, Pong, set off a revolution. Michael Pachter is an analyst at Wedbush Securities.
I remember my dad taking me to a bar. You know, we actually went into a bar. I was underage, and he wanted to show me this machine where you could play Pong.
That machine was one of the first arcade video games, and it put Atari on the map. But the company made its real mark in the late 70s with the release of the video gaming console. Patrick Scott Patterson is a longtime gamer and an amateur gaming historian.
People, once upon a time, would use the word Atari in place of the term video games. Atari established what video gaming was.
Atari was sold to Warner, today known as Time Warner, and for a time it was one of Warner's main moneymakers. But the competition came quickly, the video gaming industry crashed in the 80s, and Atari never regained its perch. Instead, it was sold to a series of companies, including Hasbro and its current owner, Infogram. In a press release, Atari said that the bankruptcy filing would allow it to make a comeback. But longtime industry watchers aren't buying it. Kurt Vandell is the author of Atari, Business is Fun.
They've used up all their lifelines. It's not a happy situation. In reality, the time has come.
Vandell expects someone will buy the Atari name, but says that Xbox, Nintendo's Wii, and the industry that Atari gave birth to have nothing to worry about. I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Can I say something bad about hope? I know we're all supposed to be for it, but hope isn't always such a good thing.
Wait, what? But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street was still in an upbeat mood after its best performance in 5 years last week. The Dow Industrials climbed 62 points on this Tuesday, nearly a half percent, finished at 13,712. The NASDAQ added 8 points, a quarter percent, wrapped up at 3,143. The S&P 500 gained 6 points. 0.4%, 1492, the number there. Morgan Stanley led financial stocks upward by 2.5%. Bank of America added 1.8%. Goldman Sachs tacked on 1%. Insurance company Travelers claimed 2% after taking a hit from Hurricane Sandy. DuPont added 1.75% on high demand for plastics from automakers. Delta Airlines climbed 3% today on plans to cut seating capacity and overhead costs. Boeing dropped 1%. Yes, Dreamliner, of course. Johnson & Johnson's forecast of lower-than-expected profits this year took off 0.75% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.84%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org.
Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook. From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Wednesday. The 9th Annual State of the Net Conference, focusing on internet policy issues, concludes in Washington. Amgen and Apple release quarterly earnings. And it's National Pie Day, at least according to those pie pushers at the American Pie Council. Fine, I'll eat pie. Twist my arm. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You have to go back a long ways to find a time when the graduation rate from public high schools in this country was as high as it has been recently. Got to go back to the class of 1974, to be precise. The Education Department said so this morning. And it is mostly good news for the economy, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
For starters, high school graduates earn $130,000 more during their lifetimes than dropouts. And the Education Department says 78% of high school students are now graduating, a number not seen in almost four decades. John Gompertz heads America's Promise Alliance, an education advocacy foundation.
If you have less than a high school diploma, you're likely to make $9 an hour or less. If you have a high school diploma, you're likely to make more than $20 an hour.
Bob Wise is president of the Alliance for Excellent Education. He says Wall Street and Main Street will love these new graduation numbers because our economy depends so much on consumer spending. We need more of those $20 an hour graduates.
Whom do you want walking into your retail mall, into your bank? The $9 an hour person doesn't get in there. The $20, $25 an hour person is the one that will fuel the economy.
Of course, we still have a long way to go. Minority graduation rates still lag behind. Rufina Hernandez is executive director of the Campaign for High School Equity. She says, for example, almost 30% of Hispanic students drop out.
We're not going to receive the benefit of their innovation, their skills, and our economy will go further and further into decline.
Because Hernandez says more and more of our future workforce will be minority students, many now struggling in high school. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Down in Georgia, deer hunting season has just wrapped up. It's a time of year that has usually coincided with tons of venison being delivered to regional food banks down there. Those food banks then distribute that meat to local food pantries and charities to feed the hungry. Not this year, though. Marketplace's Jim Burris explains the economy is partly to blame for the drop-off in deer meat.
Just how much of a drop-off has there been?
We didn't receive any.
Dave Iverson heads a food pantry near Augusta, Georgia.
We usually normally get somewhere between 200 and 300 pounds of meat, but this year we didn't get any.
That's a big deal to Iverson's pantry, which uses the donated venison to supplement its meals. Craig Garner coordinates food donations for the Golden Harvest Community Food Bank. He says a little venison goes a long way for the 300 nonprofits his agency serves.
Spaghetti sauce, chili, meatloaf, and by using it that way, it can go a lot further.
Deer meat donations to Golden Harvest are down by more than half this year, Garner says. John Becker has an idea why. He's president and CEO of the Food Bank of Northeast Georgia. It's a regional organization that provides food to smaller food pantries. He says hunters just aren't giving as much venison away.
There's a lot more people out of work, and they need to put meat on the table. And so they're hunting to feed their families.
Becker says past years have seen upwards of 20,000 pounds of donated deer meat. This year, it's in the hundreds. And it's not only meat in short supply. Charitable donations to process it are down, too. Food banks hope this year is an anomaly and not the start of a trend. I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Los Angeles Times consumer columnist David Lazarus was bitten by his cat a couple of months ago, a story which you might rightly surmise wouldn't usually find a place on this particular radio program were it not for the ensuing infection and journey through the healthcare system that it brought David to, the billing process, to be specific. So we brought him in to talk about it. Hey, David, how are you?
I'm really good, thanks.
Let me see the hand, man.
There you go. Look at
it. Oh, yeah. No, there's a scar.
Yeah, you can see it. I mean, they cut me here and here, opened it up, flushed it out, and hopefully I'm on the mend.
And then they sent you the bill.
And then they sent me the bill. And I got to say, the nurses, the doctors, the treatment, U.S. healthcare, it's great.
Yeah.
It's superlative. Yes. When it comes to the delivery of your bill, I got some quibbles.
You were in the hospital for a number of days.
Six nights.
$4,000 a night.
$4,000 a pop. I called around. I can get a suite at the Beverly Hills Hotel for less than that. And moreover, my hospital room didn't even have HBO.
Really?
Really.
That is so
And then you
lame.
Can go further than that. I mean, you're looking at $12,000 for the actual surgery, $780 for the anesthesia, $3,000 for the MRI, the various drugs, $3,000. They had to put a little tube in my arm so I could do an IV drip at home.
Yeah.
That's more than $2,000 right there.
You talked to the guy who runs the hospital you were in. It's the UCLA Medical Center. You talked to him and you said, Dr. Feinberg, what the? And what did he say?
Well, what's nice is he immediately fell on his sword and he said, you know what? I get bills that I also don't understand.
Oh, that's interesting.
But at least he was able to explain to me the method behind the madness when it comes to healthcare billing in this country. And it all basically stems from the discounts that are contractually given to insurers in return for them bringing scads of patients into hospitals. So what do the hospitals do? They jack up all the prices so that the prices become so inflated that once the discount kicks in, they'll still be able to make a profit. That's the problem, because now we have no transparency in the healthcare system. You actually have no idea what any particular thing really costs.
I wanted to ask you about a thing that caught my eye in this piece. So plus or minus $52,000 bill, your insurance is going to cover $38,000 of that. You owe $1,500, which leaves roughly $14,000 unaccounted for. And Dr. Feinberg, who runs the hospital you were at, said what to you when you asked him about that?
Basically said, don't worry your pretty head about that.
$14,000, David.
He said it's funny money. That's a direct quote. Now, Kai, I just want to point out, we spend about $3 trillion a year on healthcare in this country. That's 17% of all economic activity. That's more than anybody else. And we're talking about funny money?
Funny, that's insane.
I mean, really? That's even a part of the picture?
Is Obamacare going to fix any of this?
It could. Dr. Feinberg at UCLA says that one of the little fine print things that not a lot of people are talking about is the fact that there's going to be a new emphasis on wellness, by which I mean your insurer will give a hospital, will give your doctor a set amount of money per year. The doctor's job is to keep you well, and if he or she succeeds in that, they pocket the difference. No longer will there be this need for all these padded bills and all these inflated costs.
This is an entertaining column. It's a crazy story, but it's also arguably American health insurance working the way it should, right?
You could say that.
You had a problem. You got treated. You had to pay something for it. Your insurance covered the rest, and boom, you move on.
I had no hassles.
Right.
So, okay, there's that.
Right.
$1,500. Let's just say $3,000
sure.
once you add in all the other costs.
Because you got to keep your hand.
I got my hand. Thank you. I've got the physical therapy. So $3,000 out of pocket for a $55,000 bill. There's going to be a lot of people who say, what are you griping about?
Shut up. Yeah.
Fair enough. Okay, but let's turn that on its head. The average worker pays more than $4,000 a year in premiums for family coverage. So is $3,000 out of pocket a good deal, a bad deal? I don't know, because I don't know how much anything costs.
You still have the cat?
Still have the cat.
David Lazarus, he's with the Los Angeles Times and also occasionally on our personal finance show. It's called Marketplace Money. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
In his inaugural address yesterday, President Obama used the word hope 3 times, which is, as it turns out, the same number of times he used it 4 years ago when his campaign had largely been defined by that word. For the past couple of days, we've been asking writers how hope might be different now. Here's Pulitzer Prize winner Jeffrey Eugenides.
Can I say something bad about hope? I know we're all supposed to be for it, but hope isn't always such a good thing. There's this guy I know named Ted who's on Match.com. Ted's 54. On the site, he's 41. He's looking for a woman with a nice personality between 22 and 30. Ted's between jobs. He's living with his brother-in-law in the basement in Tempe, Arizona. Ted's likes are pistol fishing, barbecue, and Levon Helm's middle period. Who would deny Ted's right to find love? Only what happens is when, semi-miraculously, this woman named Arlene responds to Ted's ad and they go out for barbecue. It further happens that Arlene is actually way into Levon Helm, so that they both end up, a month later, in bed, softly singing the lyrics of Watermelon Time in Georgia to each other. It turns out that Ted continues to go on Match.com in the interim to see if there's anyone else out there. Anyone better. Ted's got hope. In this economy, hope's like anything else. When it comes to love, a savvy consumer can always get an upgrade. But hope isn't an escape clause. It isn't a getaway car. Hope's more like telling the girl you want to marry how great a husband you'll be, and then going and being that person. You can shout and sloganeer about hope all you want, but it won't matter. Hope isn't wishful thinking. It's full of requirements.
The most recent book from Jeffrey Eugenides is called The Marriage Plot. You can check out our entire inauguration author series at our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, and it's a little bit existential, I'll warn you in advance, but somehow appropriate on a day when two of the three major stock indices closed at five-year highs. There is another index we might want to pay heed to today. It's called the VIX, also known as the Volatility Index, or sometimes the Fear Index. It's a measure of how worried Wall Street is about what's coming down the pike. Not at all worried, it seems. The VIX is at five-year lows this week, and I just wonder if maybe we don't want Wall Street to be just a little bit afraid? I don't know. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 62 points, nearly a half percent. The NASDAQ added 8 points, a quarter percent. The S&P 500 up 6 points, 0.4%. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Katie Long, and Justin Ho on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Bead. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.